The sun has gone down at Hangman's Hill, and the ghost at Misery Corner isn't walking tonight. So, welcome to the Weird Tales Radio Show, your weekly fix of ghost stories, urban myths, witchcraft, magic, and folklore. And now, here's your host, writer, award-winning journalist, best-selling author, and sometime werewolf hunter, Charles Christian.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Weird Tales Radio Show with me, Charles Christian. Thank you for tuning in again. As we've just had the autumnal equinox, which is also the pagan harvest festival of Mabon, yes, we are now at the halfway point, in the Northern Hemisphere at least, between the longest day and the shortest day, we're going to be talking about witchcraft, practical magic, and, weirdly, the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game with London-based witch Lucia Starza. And, as September 26 is the feast of St. Cyprian of Antioch, we're also going to be looking at the curious legend of the patron saint of sorcerers and witches. Let's get on with the show. Now for this week's guest, Lucia Starza. She is an eclectic witch living in London, England, with her husband and cats. She is the author of several books in the Pagan Portals series, including Candle Magic, Poppets and Magical Dolls, and Guided Visualizations. She also edited the community book Everyday Magic, A Pagan Book of Days, and, as Lucia Shaznowski, she co-wrote Call of Cthulhu role-playing game supplements and scenarios published by Chaosium. It's my great pleasure to be talking to Lucia Starza.
Hello.
Now, you run the Bad Witch blog, which you describe as paganism, witchcraft, and day-to-day experiences of a London witch. So, tell us a little bit more about that.
Right. Well, I started writing it, I think we're going on for about 15 years ago. Largely, I wanted to do more pagan stuff. I was a bit of a lapsed witch. I'd been in a coven and many years before, and then the coven had kind of gone its separate ways, and I was a bit of a lapsed witch, but I wanted an incentive to read more books about paganism, do more witchy stuff, go out and visit witchy places, and having a blog that I needed to write gave me that incentive. I read up a little bit about how to write a blog, and at the time it was saying, well, it's ideal if you can blog every day. It's like, oh goodness, that's a little bit scary, blogging every day, but okay, I'll give it a go, like Monday to Friday every morning writing a blog post. And I've just kind of got into the habit with it now, and I do often write them a little bit in advance. Sometimes I write them on the morning, but every morning, Monday to Friday, and sometimes at the weekends, I post a blog post. I blog about events that are happening in London. And at the moment, there's a lot of online events too, because obviously yes, with lockdown, that's just brilliant. So I blog about events. I blog about books. I blog about places that I visit. I blog about just my general thoughts, and all sorts of things about folklore and history and magic and witchcraft and paganism.
No, that's brilliant. No, I've been looking at it. There's a wonderful amount of material there, and well done you writing all that stuff. And you're also writing books as well.
Yes, yes. Well, my main job was as a writer. I was a feature writer on a local London newspaper for many years, and then I got into doing editing, and I was doing sub-editing on a freelance basis for a number of newspapers. And then when the Moon Books imprint started up, which is part of John Hunt Publishing, I sent an email off to the editor and said, do you need a freelance proofreader or sub-editor. He said, well, actually, we do. So for many years, I was the copy editor for Moon Books. And then after a few years, I said, well, you know, I'd like to put in an idea for a book. He said, well, okay, fine. So I wrote my first book for Moon Books, which was Pagan Portals Candle Magic. And that's now become a bestseller. It's done really well. And I've also written a book on poppets and magical dolls. I edited the book Everyday Magic, A Pagan Book of Days. And that was a community book. I don't get any royalties from that. But it gave existing Moon Books writers and people who hadn't had books published before an opportunity to contribute. And it's got something for every day of the year, which might be a meditation, it might be something to do, it might be some folklore for that day, it might be a spell, it might be a ritual. So it's something for every day of the year. And then my book that's coming out in December is Pagan Portals Guided Visualizations, Pathways into Wisdom and Witchcraft.
And what's that about?
Well, guided visualizations are like meditations, but they're guided.
Right.
There are a number of different phrases that get used for similar things. So there's like meditations, guided meditations, path workings, guided visualizations and creative visualizations. And they're all subtly different. I picked on guided visualizations really because path working is a phrase that more generally originates in Kabbalah, and you get Kabbalistic path working. So I kind of leave that for Kabbalistic workings. And that's not what I was writing, more about witchy type path. Yes. Visualizations. And a meditation can really be like mindfulness and that kind of thing. And a guided meditation can be something to help you visualize on an image or something like that. So it's very similar. But guided visualizations are more, they can involve taking you on a journey, like a story in which you visualize going on that journey and making your own choices as you go. So that was why I picked on that particular title.
Yes. Now, candle magic, that's sort of self-explanatory and very popular, and all the shops that sell esoteric paraphernalia, they all have all the candles and all the different sorts, and we all know about that. But the poppets and magical dolls, I mean, the poppets bit, people immediately think, or they do if you're like me, they immediately think of a rather ugly doll that you stick pins in it because you want to cause pain to somebody.
Well, they have been used for that over the years, and there's no doubt about that. If you go to the Museum of Witchcraft and Magic, they probably have, I think, about 60% of the magical poppets they have there have been used for that. You know, a lot haven't. There's a lot of good luck dolls. It's got a very ancient history, the use of effigies or images. It's the oldest type of magic. In fact, one of the oldest spells recorded in ancient Mesopotamia is actually a healing spell. It's a cure for dog bite. And if you get bitten by a dog back in ancient Mesopotamia, what you did is you went to the riverbank and you got some clay and you rubbed it on the wound. Then you made a little effigy of the dog that bit you and you left it in the sun. And as the clay dried up in the sun, so your wound was supposed to dry up and heal and, you know, not get infected. So it's definitely been used for healing a lot, in also for fertility. In ancient Egypt, there were what they call paddle dolls. And that's because they were wooden dolls in the shape of a paddle.
Mm-hmm.
And although they were children's toys, they were also considered to be protective magic for children and for pregnant mothers. In Africa, fertility dolls, there's quite a tradition of fertility dolls and dolls as spirit houses to perhaps hold helpful spirits that might be spirits of your ancestors, although also maybe to trap unhelpful spirits, the ones you don't want around.
Yes.
In England, there was, and in other parts of Europe back in medieval times, there was a big tradition that if you were unwell, you might make a wax effigy of yourself or of the part of the body that was hurt, like a leg or a foot mm-hmm. or an arm or whatever, and then take that wax effigy to a sacred place, which could be like a shrine or whatever, yes. or a church or a cathedral, or yes. and you left that there. And the idea was that the healing energy would go into the wax effigy, but like help you.
Yes.
Although you went back to your work or whatever, and it would help you heal. So, yes. My book is primarily about ways you can use magical dolls to help yourself in your daily life. I do go into traditional curses, and one of the most famous ones that gets quoted in the Pendle witch trials, when the Pendle witches were accused of of being witches.
Yeah.
And in Elizabeth Demdike's confession, she reportedly said that the easiest way to hurt someone is to get some clay and make an effigy of them and just stick pins in it. It has been used for that. But I think in the past, people have tended to think more about witches using effigies for harmful magic, but they've definitely been used for beneficial magic as well.
Right, right, yes. Is that what's known as sympathetic magic, where you are channeling your powers, if you like, through something that represents the object you're trying to influence?
Yeah, absolutely, yes, sympathetic magic. And I also think the thing with a doll or a puppet, and the origin of the word poppet, it's a medieval word, but it comes from the same origin as puppet. Mm-hmm. And when I was writing my book, I went to stay at, I think it was a Travelodge, I hope I've got the chain right, but they had some adverts at that time for people going away on holiday with a little puppet of themselves. And the puppet was kind of representing themselves doing the thing they wanted to do on their holiday, whether that was relaxing or doing something adventurous. And I was actually staying in Glastonbury, and I at the Travelodge, and I saw all these adverts around the place. It's like, that is exactly how you can use a magical doll. It was kind of strange that some modern advertising was giving me good ideas for my book. And you can do that. If there's some aspect of yourself that you want to do more, you want to be more adventurous, you want to be healthier, you want to be more lucky, whatever it is you want to do, you can make a doll and give it the symbols of that. So if it's perhaps a new job, you could like dress it in the clothing of you'll wear doing that job. And it helps you visualize yourself getting that job, and it will kind of help you get into that role that you want to do. So there are many ways you can use them.
That's where I went wrong in my life. I should have had a doll of me as whatever I wanted to be, as opposed to just apply for jobs. Yes.
Oh.
No, that's intriguing. Now, one of the things you mentioned earlier is you're talking about paganism and witchcraft. Mm. And you use the terms, because a lot of people say are very much, witchcraft. No, it's Wicca and it's a religion, and paganism is something else. Where do you sit on that divide?
Well, I am a gardener. I'm an initiated gardenerian Wiccan.
Right.
Second degree. And the term Wicca at one time really did mean the initiatory lineages of either gardenerian or Alexandrian Wicca.
Yeah.
But it's become more a general term for kind of a modern type of witchcraft. And so you will see people using it in different ways. Now, as a Gardnerian Wiccan, I'm both a pagan and a witch and a priestess. So that's three things, not two things, isn't it? Yes. So, but yes, there are some forms of Wicca where they see it as purely being a religion. And there are other Wiccans, presumably, who really do more of the spellwork side, not that interested in the priestess side.
Yes.
But for me, they're both important. These days, I call myself more an eclectic witch. I'm very interested in traditional folk magic, and I mean, Wicca is really a modern pagan form of witchcraft. But back in history, there were witches in cultures all over the world, and they would follow many different religions and yes. none. It's not exclusive to paganism. You know, there were definitely Christian witches out there, or witches who identified as Christians, even though yes. other Christians might have thought they were very naughty Christians.
Yes.
They definitely identified as Christians.
Going on to one of the things you were talking about with events, I think one of the things I'm noticing just on some of the Facebook groups I follow is there's a lot of people who are having difficulty making, in these times of lockdown, particularly if they've moved, making contact with new covens or, you know, witches in their new area. And as you say, it's very much everything's online at the moment. What's sort of your best advice for people who are either wanting to get into witchcraft, Wicca, or find new contacts in a new area? Because, you know, there's obviously an element of it's a bit like Fight Club. You know, the first rule of a coven is you don't talk about the coven to outsiders.
Well, yeah, I mean, there is an element of that, because you want to be a group of like-minded people, and because if you need to be all on the same wavelength.
Yes.
And if you've got covens where there are people all pulling in different directions, it's just not gonna work. Same with any group, really.
Yeah.
But I think especially if you're working magic, you really do need to be, you know, all singing from the same page of the hymn book, to use a simile that's not perhaps appropriate. But I mean. There are organisations that are, and have been for a long while, very helpful to people who are seekers in witchcraft and paganism. The Pagan Federation, does have a big Facebook presence. So that's a good organisation.
Yeah.
Also, Children of Artemis, they run Witch Fest, which is normally an amazing witchcraft convention every year, and other smaller events. But this summer they did Witchfest online rather than having a physical
yes.
event, with lots of talks. And they also have a big Facebook presence, and online presence. So Children of Artemis is very good.
Yeah.
The Centre for Pagan Studies, they also have a Facebook page, and they've been doing online talks. So I would say that they are very good. Also, Treadwell's Bookshop in London does an amazing series of talks and lectures and workshops, and they were in their shop. The shop is currently being refurbished, but be opening again. But since lockdown, they've been doing a lot of online lectures and talks and workshops, and they really do a lot of excellent workshops for young witches or for people who are new to witchcraft. So I'd really recommend going to Treadwell's Bookshop website as well and having a look at what they've got there.
Yeah, they are a brilliant resource, and it's a brilliant shop altogether.
Mm.
How did you get into it? You know, were there people in your family, or did you have some moment in your youth where you saw the light, or you decided to change, or what? You know, it's always intrigues me. What starts people off? going into non-traditional religions, non-traditional approaches?
Well, my family was a bit weird. back at school, people used to say my family was like the Addams Family, which at the time I found embarrassing. But, you know, in hindsight, I think it's quite cool, really. My grandma was an astrologer. She worked for, in her youth, she worked for a very famous astrologer, Alan Leo. She was his secretary. And I've still got a lot of the manuscripts for his books that she typed up. And she worked as an astrologer. When she got older, she actually, astrology was more a sideline, and she was working as a bookkeeper for another firm. But in her youth, she was an astrologer. She was also a theosophist, which is very much in the history of a lot of occult and esoteric traditions.
Yes.
My dad, that's my grandma was my mum's mum.
Yeah.
My dad, although he was Catholic, he was absolutely fascinated with the unexplained. He was into dowsing. He was into palm reading. He was really very, he used to write about it too. And he used to have a regular radio show on Radio Free Europe where he talked about the supernatural, ghosts and the unexplained, that kind of thing. So he was really fascinated by that kind of thing. He used at the school fete every year, he used to run the palmistry stall. and he was also into UFOs really big time. So when I was a kid, I remember many of my childhood holidays as a tiny child being taken all around Wiltshire and either sitting on hilltops waiting for UFOs, and I was always really disappointed that they didn't turn up, or dowsing around sacred sites, because back then you could like go right up to Stonehenge with your dowsing rods. And
yes,
so but they didn't call themselves witches. I mean, back when I was a kid in the 1960s, it was still kind of a rude word, you know.
Yeah.
If you called someone a witch, you meant they were mean and nasty.
Yes.
So no, they didn't call themselves witches, but they were definitely into weird stuff. I really became a witch more in my 20s when I met other people who did identify as witches, and I learned that it was an acceptable term that people were choosing to use. And really, to cut a long story short, I was at a Pagan Federation London Open ritual and made a friend who was in a Wiccan coven, and she said it was a really good training coven. So I thought, okay, yeah, that sounds good. I trained there for the traditional year and a day, and then I was initiated. So that's how I became a witch.
Mm-hmm. Now, without giving away any craft secrets, but what does the training involve when you say it's for a year and a day? It's presumably not turning up 9 till 5.
No.
What does somebody who wants to take witchcraft seriously, what are they letting themselves in for?
Well, it will vary from coven to coven very much, but in the training coven that I was in, and it was, I mean, the high priestess was so dedicated to it. It was one evening a week, so it was like going to an evening class.
Yeah.
And then quite often at weekends there would be rituals. Now, if in Wiccan covens, most actual rituals, you have to be an initiate to come along, but they do some open rituals that trainees can come along to, and some very open rituals, perhaps in a public park, that members of the public can come along to. I was going along one evening a week, and then sometimes at weekends, and it covered a whole variety of different things. Some of it was practical, so like learning to sort of raise energy, magical energy, learning how to sense magical energy. And some people will see it, some people will feel it. I feel it more than see it. I can see it sometimes, but some people see it, some people feel it. And also like learning about what Wicca is all about, learning about different gods and goddesses, learning about the elements. I mean, one of the things that trainee witches often get given to do to start with is to do exercises on the different elements, so earth, air, fire, water, and spirit, working out what they mean to them and that kind of thing. A whole variety of different stuff.
In terms of magic, what has been, if you like, the most spectacular conjuration or magic you've ever practiced or witnessed? Because a lot of people talk about it and then it's very much, you don't see anything, it's just something that happens.
Oh, so do you mean something like, I would say, yes, you tend to not see visual effect. You can do, but the visual effects you will see as you're doing the spell tend to be subtle. So they tend to be you're sensing the change in energy. When you raise energy in a circle, I will feel a prickling over my skin. It's like, like a little prickling of energy over my skin. And I often see energy more as a kind of like a smoky haze, sometimes with colours in it. Other people will see it more spectacularly. But it's not things like, throwing fireballs around or anything like
that.
Well,
that's
very subtle.
Yes, I mean, that's the thing, that the depiction of magic on television and movies is the fireballs flying around the place. I'm just intrigued to know, but...
There are quite a few exercises, and in fact, in my candle magic book, there is a little exercise for, helping you see the energy of what you're doing. But a lot of it is more like in Star Wars, where they say, feel the Force.
Right.
When I'm doing spells, sometimes I get a feeling is that I'm really pushing against something here. That is not going to work. I'm going to have to find a different way. I was doing a little bit of healing magic for a friend's cat who was rather unwell at the weekend. And I was doing the magic and it's like, my friend was really worried because the cat was sleeping a lot. So it was like, not wanting to eat and wanting to sleep. And I really got the feeling this cat really needs to get a lot of sleep. It'll be all right, but it really needs to sleep. So it's like, I'm not going to push to get this cat to go and eat its food because what it needs to do at the moment is sleep.
Yes. Which, of course, with human complaints, very often getting a good long session of sleep does wonders for the body. And of course, suppose the thing with cats is they often spend so much time sleeping anyway, it'd be hard to tell the difference. Yes.
You're listening to the Weird Tales radio show with Charles Christian.
Now, we've got the autumnal equinox or Mabon coming up shortly. What will you be doing to commemorate or celebrate that?
I haven't actually made my plans yet. On the 23rd, which is the day after the autumn equinox, I'm giving a talk on moon books. We're doing Facebook Live author talks via moon books. So on the 23rd, I will be giving a talk and I'm going to be covering a variety of different magical things you can do for the autumn equinox, even though it's the day after the autumn equinox, but also post-autumn equinox, because after the equinox, you're going to the dark time of the year. And I think some people, and I do, I know this, it's like, oh my goodness, it's all downhill from here. And it's a little bit of, you get the blues.
It's a bit depressing.
Bit.
Yeah, the nights, notice the nights drawing in. And
so I'm going to be covering spells and magic you can do to perhaps help keep your spirits up and keep a good mood as the nights draw in, as well as covering some things you can do to mark the autumn equinox. But one of the things that I normally do, both at the spring and the autumn equinox, is a little candle ritual where I light one white candle and one dark candle and make two lists. And one list is things that I want less of in my life, and the other list is things I want more of in my life. And so it's kind of trying to get some balance and assessing where I am and where I've, you know, over the last 6 months, what have I done and what do I need to do to move forwards?
And this year, that's going to be very pertinent, because a lot of people have felt that the last 6 months have been in a kind of limbo with lockdown and life not being like it normally is. Yes. As you say, we're moving then into the darker months, and it's really, as you say, a sort of a time for not quite a spring cleaning, but an autumnal cleaning and deciding where you're going for the next half of the year.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yes, it's definitely for, you know, we're near the end of the harvest. You know, it's taking stock of what you have harvested, whether that is apples from your garden or, but it's, you know, in our modern day and age, it's more likely to be what you've done and what you've achieved. And I think that even though, I mean, I know that I am lucky because, you know, my husband has been working. So I've not been desperately short of money. I know a lot of people have been desperately short of money. So I know that I've been lucky, but it's kind of looking back, well, you know, what have I achieved? What have been the bonuses? And I mean, as I said, for me, it's been, I've been able to attend meetings and with all over the world, or even just ones in London that I wouldn't be able to have the time or money to go to. Last Sunday, I double booked myself for two different events, but I could switch. They were like a series, both were a series of talks, but I could like switch between the two because they were both on Zoom. And in real life, yes, one would have been in Bath and one would have been in London, and I couldn't have done both.
Yes. No, that's a good point. That's a good point now. Yeah. And you've mentioned you've got your new book coming out later this year, I think you said, Guided Visualizations.
Yes, it should be in the shops, I would imagine, end of November. Amazon tends to send copies out a little bit later than the shops get it. So yeah. I believe Amazon will be sending it out on the 11th of December, but you can pre-order it now. Yeah. You can pre-order it, and shops should get it in a few weeks before that. So if you want a copy a bit earlier, then I'd say put in an order at Treadwell's and they'll make sure you get your copy.
Yeah.
But if you don't mind waiting, you can order it on Amazon.
Yeah. And what's your next project in terms of writing books? Because I know all writers, as soon as they're working on one book or coming to an end of it, they've already got pages full of notes for the next book. What are you thinking on looking at doing next?
Well, for Moon Books, I'm halfway through writing a book on scrying, which is like crystal ball reading, black mirrors, bowls of water. So Pagan Portal Scrying. And I'm halfway through that. However, my really exciting project, I'm working on, do you know the Rivers of London novels?
Indeed. Yes, indeed.
Well,
yes.
Chaosium is bringing out a Rivers of London role-playing game. I'm writing the section about London, as the name Lucia Starza. Actually, my father's name was Anthony Valerian Starza Shotnovsky. And so I have written a few role-playing things for Chaosium in the past. I wrote the London guidebook as Lucia Shotnovsky. When I wrote for Moon Books, I kind of thought, you know, Shotnovsky is a bit unpronounceable, so I call myself Lucia Starza. But the name that I write for Chaosium is Lucia Shotnovsky. But yes, I'm nearly finished with my London, writing the London section for the Rivers of London role-playing game. And I don't know quite when that will be out. You know, the book has to be really good. You know, they're not going to rush it. It's going to be, it is so exciting. And it's the most exciting thing I've done for a long while, I have to say.
That'd be very good, because there are a lot of specific locations in those books. You do, I mean, I used to live in London, so I know the areas, and you do find yourself you know, you can picture them all. But for people who aren't familiar with London, that would be very, very useful to get that over. That's very good. And Chaosium, they are one of the major role-playing game companies around.
They published the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game, which is quite a famous one, and that's what I've written for in the past. I wrote the London Guidebook for Call of Cthulhu, and I wrote scenarios for Strange Eons and Before the Fall, and I contributed to a few of their supplements back in a while ago.
Yes.
And then I really concentrated on when I started working on the local newspaper. I didn't really have much time to do that. So although I do in my spare time when I'm not being a witch, I do enjoy playing games. I wasn't really writing for games companies. But then I found out about this. It's like, oh my goodness, I have to write for this. So I contacted them and said, please take me on your team of writers. And I was so pleased when they said yes. So it's a lovely team. It's just, very exciting.
Well, on that high spot, thank you very much, Lucia, for your time and your insights. That has been very, very useful and very enjoyable.
Well, thank you.
And good luck with your projects in the future.
Thank you very much indeed.
You can find links to all Lucia Starza's Pagan Portal books, published by Moon Books, on her excellent Bad Witch blog at www.badwitch.co.uk. The blog also contains a highly comprehensive listing of upcoming pagan events in the London area and online.
England, home to zombies, werewolves, green-skinned fairy folk. And how about dragons, strange monoliths and vampires? If you're fascinated by the bizarre and unexplained, join Charles on a road trip around the newly discovered Wald-Newton Triangle, where fact is much weirder than any fiction. Check out Charles Christian's fantastic Kindle book, A Travel Guide to Yorkshire's Weird Wolds, on amazon.co.uk and amazon.com.
Of all the saints of the Christian Church, one of the most anomalous must surely be St. Cyprian, who, after his martyrdom in the early 4th century, became known as the patron saint of sorcerers. Yeah, sorcerers. Even more curious is the fact that some 1700 years after his death, the name of St. Cyprian is still evoked in rituals by some practitioners of black magic. How did this strange state of affairs evolve? Let's start with the legend of St. Cyprian, and to avoid confusion, we are talking about St. Cyprian, the Bishop of Antioch, not to be confused with St. Cyprian of Carthage, another early Christian bishop who was martyred about 50 years before our St. Cyprian. The story starts with Cyprian, who, as a pagan child, was dedicated to the service of the Greek god Apollo. He then entered into the mysteries of the Roman god Mithras at the age of 7 and was entrusted to the care of magicians to study sorcery. His studies would take him all over the ancient world to gather occult knowledge, or as one account puts it, he participated in the Eleusinian mysteries where, and I quote, he carried the torch of the Greek goddess Demeter, wore the white garments of Kore, otherwise known as Persephone, the daughter of Demeter, and served the serpent of Pallas, one of the Greek titans, before being sent to Mount Olympus, where, living only on fruits and acorns, he learned to control the weather and the seas, as you do. At the age of 10, yes, this was an unusual education, he learned divination from the movement of animals, the sound of trees, and from the whispers of the dead. At the age of 15, he lived in Argos and served the goddess Juno, where he learned the arts of deception. He then lived on the Greek Isle of Ikara, where he served the goddess Diana, and then Sparta, where he mastered necromancy and incantations on how to commune with the dead among the graves there. And then, at the age of 20, he moved to Memphis in Egypt, where he learned the ways of demonic possession,
demonology, and how to magically induce natural disasters. Finally, at the age of 30, he lived with the Chaldeans amid the ruins of Babylon, where he mastered astrology and herbalism, as well as the motions of ether, fire, and light, before moving to Antioch, modern-day Antakya on the southern coast of Turkey, where he became known as a powerful sorcerer, the go-to source for love potions, charms, and incantations, as well as a man who could both cast out demons and invoke them to afflict his enemies. It is in Antioch that our story really takes off when, one day, a young man called Aglaidas asked Cyprian to use his magic to help him win the love of a beautiful woman called Justina. Although Cyprian cast several love spells and even sent a demon to tempt Justina, the magic had no effect on the woman, who was a devout Christian and spent most of her time in prayer. Seeing his magic fail, in despair, Cyprian made the sign of the cross, whereupon, in the words of Fox's Book of Martyrs, he was immediately freed from the toils of Satan. Cyprian went on to renounce sorcery and the black magic arts, burned all his books of spells, converted to Justina's religion, Christianity, was baptized. He subsequently became a deacon, a priest, and finally the bishop of Antioch. Incidentally, the would-be lover Aglaidas also converted to Christianity, while Justina herself went on to take vows of chastity and became an abbess of the local convent. Despite the inauspicious start of their relationship, Cyprian and Justina worked together, in a purely platonic way, for the Christian community in Antioch, with Justina going on to be described as Cyprian's sister in Christ. However, the first part of our story does not have a happy ending, for at this time Christianity was still barely tolerated within the Roman Empire, and in the year AD 304, both Cyprian and Justina were dragged away to the local provincial capital of Nicomedia, modern-day Izmit in Turkey, where the Roman Emperor Diocletian demanded they either renounce Christianity and resume worshipping the old gods, or else face the consequences. They chose the latter option. Neither would abandon their faith, so, as they knew would be their fate, they were tortured, in their case being thrown into a cauldron of boiling water, but, the legend says, no harm befell them, so they were then both beheaded. Cyprian and Justina's deaths were part of what would become known as the Great Persecution, the last major persecution of Christians in the Roman Empire, when, over the period AD 303 to 313, approximately 20,000 Christians were put to death. But our story does not end there. Both Cyprian and Justina were later canonized, that is, made saints, and are still venerated by the Eastern Orthodox Church, the Oriental Orthodoxy, which includes the Coptic, Syriac, Armenian and Eritrean Christian churches, and the Roman Catholic Church. In the West, St. Cyprian's feast day is celebrated on the 26th of September. In the East, it is celebrated on the 2nd of October. Cyprian's feast day actually appeared in the Roman calendar of rites from the 13th century through to 1969, when it was removed because of lack of historical evidence of his existence. St. Valentine is another of the early Christian martyrs who suffered a similar fate in the mid-20th century. Cyprian's name was also removed from the subsequent 2001 revision of the Roman Martyrology, the official but incomplete list of saints recognised by the Roman Catholic Church. That said, the Martyrology still includes five other saints called Cyprian, as well as two Justinas, and some traditionist Roman Catholics still continue to observe the pre-1970 version of the Roman calendar. But back to Cyprian. Within 70 years of his death, some Christian writers were already confusing St. Cyprian of Antioch with St. Cyprian of Carthage, a situation not helped by the fact that during the 4th century, three different versions of Cyprian's life were written and circulated, and in the 5th century, a Byzantine empress and later saint, Eudoxia, pulled all three versions together to provide a definitive chronicle of Cyprian's life and times and death. Now, clearly, some elements of the legend are completely fantastical, including some of the magical powers attributed to Cyprian and the overall historical context. For example, as a child, Cyprian would not have been allowed to join the cult of Mithras. But there remain two important questions, ones that have earned our saint the nickname of Saint Cyprian the Mage, namely, when he renounced sorcery and converted to Christianity. Did he really burn all his books of spells and never practice magic again? The tradition tells, and it is this tradition that has given St. Cyprian his continued relevance through until modern times, that Cyprian only destroyed some of the manuscripts and retained the most important one of all, namely his personal collection of notes and spells, in effect, his own personal grimoire. The tradition goes on to say that while Cyprian abandoned the Black Arts, he still continued to practice magic where it could benefit and protect his fellow Christians, such as those suffering from demonic possession. For this reason, another name given to our saint is Saint Cyprian the Theurgist, in other words, a ruler of demons. A magician so powerful that he can order their coming and going, can protect people from supernatural harm, and intervene on behalf of people possessed by demons or bound by hexes and bewitching. In fact, there is even a suggestion that the Roman Catholic Church's original exorcism rites and prayers were based on the notes and spells found in Cyprian's personal grimoire. It is also interesting to note that in a 14th century manuscript of the Golden Legend, it contains an illustration showing Saint Justina blessing the sick and maimed, while in the background Cyprian is dealing with two demons. And it is in this setting that Saint Cyprian the Mage, or San Cipriana as he is frequently called, has earned the unofficial reputation of being the patron saint of witches, magicians, sorcerers, occultists, demonologists and necromancers. But what happened to St. Cyprian's grimoire after his death? The story is that copies of the grimoire, known as the Book of St. Cyprian or Libro de San Cipriana, were made so that the secret knowledge they contain could be passed down through the ages until the present day. Well, at least that is the story, but the reality is the original grimoire vanished from the historical record for over 1400 years and only resurfaced in the mid-18th century. And today, the earliest known edition of the Book of St. Cyprian, in Spanish, but supposedly translated from Latin by a German monk called Jonas Sulfuriano, or Sulfury Jonas, dates back to just the year 1810. Intriguingly, while the Wellcome Institute in London does contain a copy of a Latin manuscript, the Book of St. Cyprian is most widely available in Spanish and Portuguese editions today and has a big following in Brazil, Peru, Mexico and other parts of Latin America. There, it has been infused with Afro-Caribbean religions such as Umbanda, a syncretic Afro-Brazilian religion that blends African traditions with Roman Catholicism, Spiritism and indigenous American beliefs, and Quimbanda, a religion practiced primarily in the urban city centres of Brazil and associated with magic rituals and the Exu and Pompagira spirits. The result is that today, St. Cyprian still plays an important role in folk magic, or Bruxaria, that's the Spanish, Portuguese, Catalan word for witchcraft, as well as in root working, folk Catholicism and hoodoo practices of the South American area. In fact, if you visit one of the botanicas, these are shops selling folk medicine, religious candles and amulets in that part of the world, you'll find San Cipriano statues, spell kits, pictures, oils, soaps and candles on sale. St. Cyprian's oil apparently contains, among other things, cat, toad, snake, bat, goathorn, wormwood, dog's mercury, pennyroyal, indigo, pine, cedar, sulphur, copper filings, and the powder from 21 human skulls. You use this oil to anoint, in other words, ensoul, his candles and statues before making a prayer to the saint, such as this one for rebuffing enemies who are attacking you. Mighty Cipriana,
sorcerer of shadows and occult powers, to you whom nothing is impossible, through your conjure, by your holy dagger, cut the tongue of my enemies, the wicked and the malicious, who want to bring evil to my home. Return twice as much what was sent to me, sheltering and protecting me at all times. Amen. Saint Cyprian is even credited with being the author of the original and infamous, and please do not try this at home, hoodoo voodoo, black cat spell. This goes, cook the dead body of a black cat in boiling water with white seeds and wood from the willow until the meat is loosened from the bones. Strain the bones in a linen cloth and, in front of a mirror, place the bones one by one in your mouth until you find the bone that contains the magic to make you become invisible. Keep the bone with the magical property and, if you want to go somewhere without being seen, place the bone in your mouth. There's a handy little tip. Put a dead cat's bone in your mouth and disappear. For a relatively obscure 4th century Christian martyr, St. Cyprian's continued relevance in the 21st century is a remarkable testament to the potency of his legend, and perhaps an indication that in the insular, alienating world in which we now live, we still hanker for a connection with the ways of our ancestors. St. Justina's remains are said to rest in the Church of St. Anthony in Lisbon, Portugal, while the preserved arm of St. Cyprian, but only his arm, can be found in the Zlatari Church in Bucharest, Romania, and it's believed to have the power to lift curses and spells when touched. So there you have it, St. Cyprian, the patron saint of witchcraft, necromancy and sorcery, whose celebration takes place on Wednesday the 26th of September. And now a rather weird cocktail recipe for you. It's called the Sour Toe Cocktail, and it's available at the Sourdough. See what they've done there? Sourdough, Sour Toe. Sourdough Saloon, which is in Dawson City, Yukon Territory in Canada. And it's exactly what it sounds like. It's an actual human toe that has been dehydrated and preserved in salt and is used as a garnish in a drink of your choice. The first toe is said to have belonged to a miner and bootlegger named Louis Lycan, who had his frostbitten appendage amputated in the 1920s. Lycan preserved it in a jar of alcohol in his cabin, presumably for old time's sake, and that was it until about 50 years later. So yes, in 1973, a Yukon local called Captain Dick Stevenson found the jar containing the toe while cleaning a cabin. Captain Dick brought the toe down to the Sourdough Saloon and started plunking it into the drinks of those who were brave enough to drink. That is, brave enough to drink their, finish their drink after someone had dunked a dehydrated toe in it. And thus the Sour Toe Cocktail Club was formed. Unfortunately, the original toe only lasted 7 years because sometime in 1980, a miner named Gary Younger was trying for a Sour Toe record. On his 13th glass of Sour Toe champagne, his chair tipped over and fell over backwards, and he accidentally swallowed the toe. And the records say the toe was not recovered. Yes. Since then, 7 more toes have been donated to the bar. Toe number 2 was given after an amputation due to an inoperable corn. Yes, so you've not just got a toe, you've got a toe with a corn on it. Toe number 3 came from the victim of frostbite and was accidentally swallowed. Toe number 4 was an anonymous toe, later stolen. Toes 5 and 6 were donated by Yukon Old Timer in return for free drinks for his nurses. And toe number 7 was an amputation due to diabetes. And toe number 8 arrived in a jar of alcohol with the message, "Don't wear open-toe sandals while mowing the lawn." On August the 24th, 2013, a man ordered a sour toe shot, swallowed it,
and paid the $500 fine, which was the fine the bar had introduced to stop people eating, swallowing, stealing the tow. And then he promptly ran away. This was the first and only time the tow was deliberately consumed, as opposed to accidentally consumed. And as a result, the fine was increased to $2,500. In June 2017, the tow was stolen, but was later returned in the mail. And the rules have changed over the past 27 years. The sour tow cocktail can now be made with any drink. But one rule remains. You can drink it fast, you can drink it slow, but the lips have got to touch the tow. Know this before you go. Okay, tow time occurs nightly between 9 and 11 p.m. And the bar makes the point that this cocktail is not suitable to teetotalers. Teetotalers. Yeah, see what they did there? It's very good. Thank you. I'll pass on that one.
Good day, gentlefolk. I doth have breaking news. Your Weird Tales host, Charles Christian, has written a new book called Saints and Sinners in Dark Age England. 5 shocking true tales that are stranger than fiction. There's murder, mayhem, treason, incest, adultery, and worse. Read about the real antics of 9 saints. Yes, saints. 8 kings and 5 queens of England. Plus, the wickedest of all stepmothers. And be amazed, or horrified, or appalled, or all three. If you love weird history, and methinks you do, hop over to Amazon for your copy of Charles Christian's Saints and Sinners in Dark Age England. Grab yours now.
And that's it. Almost time to go. Safe for me to say that next week we have another treat in store as we delve into the realms of Arthurian legends with author and movie consultant John Matthews, when we discuss the mythical Dark Ages sorcerer Merlin and the many aspects of the folklore surrounding his life. Now, this is Charles Christian saying thank you so much for listening, and please join me again next week when we'll have more weird tales. Until then, stay well, stay weird, stay different.
Black Shuck, the demon dog of East Anglia, is baying at the moon, which means it's time for us to go. You've been listening to the Weird Tales radio show with Charles Christian, your weekly fix of ghost stories, urban myths, witchcraft, magic, and folklore. You can keep in touch with us online at www.weirdtalesradio.com, by email to weirdtales@icloud.com, and on Twitter at Christian Uncut. Join us again next week for another edition of the Weird Tales radio show. Good night.